Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us through WCTCAM or restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
And you can read our book, but we haven't written it yet. We're working on it, though, so you can read us.
You can read about us. Can you read about us?
You can. All right, I want to talk about reading.
Can't read about us in the New York Times.
I want to talk about reading. It's a crazy food world we're living in. The New York Times is my favorite paper and mm-hmm. one of the favorite food papers in the nation. It's really tremendous. There are many. The Jersey Weekly section of the Times, which has been folded into sort of an odd outer borough section of the Times, which appeared on Sundays, their food section is a ridiculous waste of time now. We've done a show on how they changed their ratings in a big upheld finger to all the fine dining restaurateurs in the state of New Jersey, and the state of New Jersey restaurateurs are giving that back. So there you go. But in the national section, the dining section of the Times, I think it's a great paper.
And always the most important food publication, end of story.
I've read it every Wednesday for 18 years and will continue to. Although I have to say, we've been commenting about how all food sections are thinner. You know, print publications are thinning out a little bit. And it's really challenging. I mean, papers in general are thinner.
Yeah, I guess, and Francis and I are going to criticize the Times a little bit here, but I think that we do it a little bit tongue-in-cheek because we know that print is going through a difficult time. And both of us subscribe to the Times, and both of us will continue to subscribe to the Times.
But I also think that the Times is sort of one of the most august, you know, publications. And we've seen mm-hmm. this in other papers, Time Out New York, New York Magazine. There's a lot of, through the economic downturn, we saw a lot of cheap eats. Where to get the cheapest pizza? Where to get mm-hmm. the cheapest burger? Where's the best soup in Manhattan?
One magazine basically had said cheap eats or where to get the cheapest whatever on 48 of its 52 covers.
Yeah, it's just crazy. So, the Times really took this on the front page of the New York Times food section this week.
The front page.
It says, on the front page, the top two-thirds of the page.
Right.
Eat table food? Some owners say pull up a chair, and there's a picture of a cat. And the story is about owners who make their own cat food and dog food. And it's a really intelligent, well-written story on people who make their own dog food and cat food. Why is this on the front page of the dining section? Are many cats subscribing?
See, I was thinking it should be in the business section because it's kind of a way in which we can save money. Actually, I don't know that they're saving money, although.
Well, some of them are. We may as well talk about the article and give it its proper points. The point of a lot of the pet owners in the article and people who who cook for their pets. They say for about the cost of premium dog food or cat food, you can give your pet something that's much better. And some of the folks who are in here talk about pets that would get sick a lot and would go to the vet a lot and would therefore cost them a lot of money. And their cats and their dogs would be, you know, unhappy and live and some of these conditions have gone away. Now, obviously, I assume that the dog food and cat food in a can suffers from the same worse maladies than when Americans used to eat out of a can.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea with these folks is, you know, they're eating better than they ever have. They're very conscious about their food being organic and sustainable and nutritious and holistic. And why shouldn't they feel the same way about their pets? And, of course, the answer that comes to my mind is because they're your pets, because they're animals. Not to be a speciesist. But I get it, especially if you have a cat that's sick or a dog that's sick. But I don't have any pets, but if I did, I could see going this way.
I have a pet. I don't want this article on the front page of the dining section.
that's the problem.
Okay.
Well, I also don't see you cooking for your dog under any circumstances.
You know what? More appropriate for the dining section,
is how to cook dog.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
I mean.
Listen to me. I'm sorry to anybody out there who I might have just offended.
Except for our Korean friends.
I have a dog. I've had dogs for the last 30 years. I love dogs.
Me too. They're
wonderful.
Delicious. No, I haven't really.
They're wonderful.
Hey, that's a cultural bias, man.
Yes, it is. But this doesn't belong on the front page of the dining
section. Even if it was in the back section. Even if it was on the last page of the dining section. But really, on the dining section? Dining for dogs? Oh, okay. So this must be the pet week. But I don't know if you saw, there's a second article in here. A salad with that mouse? Pet salad is a wheat. This is a separate article. This is not an advertisement. Pet salad is a wheatgrass intended as animal food. Cats especially seem to like it, but be ready to clean your rug. That's what it says. That's what it says. I don't even want to go into the specifics of it, but it might be good for your cat. It might not. It's probably going to make him puke on your carpet. What? And they sell a lot of this stuff. Oh, my God. Well, and, you know, and then the next article is on – there's an article on Pinot Noir, and then there's a picture of pancakes, and – I long for the days of foie gras and caviar.
Forget foie gras and caviar even, okay?
Yeah.
Just the dining section of the most important food section in America should have more important, more relevant things on it.
Yeah, more important things to food that humans eat. You know, I agree with you.
It's 100%. As simple as that. And you know what? If I mess up a meal, the New York Times pokes shots at me. So I'll poke some shots at the New York Times.
Yeah, got to fix that. Get the cat off the cover of my paper. Hey, listen, the Manhattan Cocktail Classic is coming up May 13th to May 17th, 2011. Last year we presented a great seminar. The restaurant guys, Mark and Francis, presented a seminar on making cocktails and putting up fruits for your bar all year round. This year they're asking people to vote on what seminars are included in the Manhattan Cocktail Classic. If you would like the restaurant guys to put on a seminar, and as we have proposed we might, you can go to ManhattanCocktailClassic.com, and we'll put a link up to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and vote for the restaurant guys and say that you think that we should be one of the ones giving a seminar at the Manhattan Cocktail Classic this year, whether you can come or not, but then we hope that you can come. So listen, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And our guest today is actually an old friend. Terry Thies is an importer of Austrian and German wines and champagne. Actually, Terry is the guy who opened my eyes to Austrian wine. I didn't know much about them. And in 94 we started buying from him. And then in 96 we went to Austria. I guess that's in the spirit of full disclosure. That can be considered a boondoggle, a perk, or an educational thing. Changed my life. And we've been friends, and we've worked together ever since. His new book, which is receiving great acclaim throughout the country, is Reading Between the Wines, Terry Thies.
Terry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back. It shows how gullible you guys are.
So, Terry, let's go back, way back to the beginning when we first met. You were importing, you weren't yet importing champagne. You were bringing in Austrian and German wines. And
yeah.
As if German wines of high quality weren't esoteric enough, you were bringing in Austrian wines, and precious few people were paying attention for a long time. And now, you know, you can't be a cool wine kid unless – a cool wine sommelier unless you really know your way around Austrian wines. But I would like to point out that we were among the first, and certainly the first in New Jersey, to have a serious Austrian wine section.
See? We were the avant-garde.
Why Austrian wines? Let's go back to Germany and Austria. Why did you decide to beat your head against a wall to introduce Austrian wines to America, which had no history of importing Austrian wines and no frame of flavor reference to appreciate them?
And lucky for you, the wall was thin and the head was thick.
David Schultnick once said that the best kind of wine merchants combine fanaticism, utopianism, and poor business sense.
Mm.
And I'd say probably by David's definition, I must be among the best wine merchants. None of it made any sense whatsoever, except that it just charged my passion. Besides, I also wanted to accumulate in my portfolio if I possibly could, every wine on earth that had umlauts in its name. You know, and I got the hots for the double dots.
Oh, you practiced that. That's not
I
spontaneous.
Did. It's not the first time I said it, but
here's
time I said it on the radio.
Here's the rule for the rest of the show. You can say very, and if any of you know Terry, those of that's a very Terry Thies-like humor, you can say any new ones you think of.
Any pun you want to include
but
must be new.
Has to be original.
Got to be new.
All right, because we're going to copyright the show, and I want it to be original. So,
okay. Well, the true story is that I've been hearing about the wines, and I was completely sort of uninterested in them because, as you pointed out, it was already difficult enough trying to make the world safe for German wines. And Stuart Pigott lived in Berncastel at the time. Stuart, by the way, for people who don't know, is a prolific writer on things Teutonic, and he publishes mostly in German because he can't get his books published in English in the United States. So Stuart at the time was living along the Mosel. He invited me for dinner. He showed me his cellar. I saw some labels I hadn't seen before. I thought I was going home. It was the wee hours of the morning, and Stuart said, "You're not leaving yet." And he took me upstairs and plied me with F.X. Pichler and Emmerich Knoll's wines.
These are Austrian producers.
These are Austrian producers, and I was so blown away by them that I decided I would go to Austria the following summer just as a tourist, just to kind of check things out. And, I mean, if I had thought the wines were good or jiggy or groovy or who knows what, I probably would have just said, well, let this be someone else's hobby horse. My life is hard enough. But I was really roused and moved by the wines and by the culture that they embodied and which embodied them. And I just, you know, just kind of came back and conducted an inner dialogue with myself. You know, it was kind of like a Goofus and Gallant moment. Anybody who remembers Children's Highlights magazine will know what I'm talking about. And, you know, Gallant is saying, but you must bring these wonderful wines to the attention of the American wine-drinking public. And then Gallant on the other shoulder is, yeah, but you're going to Goofus, rather, on the other shoulder is like, yeah, but you'll make a damn fool of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I just figured, again,
Terry never worried about making a fool of himself.
This is for sure true. It doesn't make any sense at all to be a little bit esoteric. Mm. I think once you've decided that you're going to swim against the current, then just, you know, go all the way. There's no reason to stop. And, I mean, as provided, of course, that there are wines that excite your deepest passions. And as Francis discovered for himself, lo, these many years ago when we went to Austria, and I want to assure your readers that we were children in those days.
Yeah, exactly.
And the drinking age is younger there. That's how
yeah,
we were.
Yeah, right, of course, yeah.
You know, there's really something remarkable is happening there. And to the extent that it has not entered into the mainstream of American wine geekdom, I would submit that that is because there is an unspoken and perhaps subconscious contempt for German-speaking places. And the things that happen there are thus less significant to us. If the story were taking place in Italy or Spain, it would have been all anyone could talk about for the last 15 years.
You don't think that it's just that the labels are really hard to read?
I don't think the labels are really hard to read. People who have no trouble at all mangling French, German, or Spanish words, and they do all the time, stand in front of a German label with its umlauts, and these otherwise incredibly competent people become immediately paralyzed.
Mm-hmm. We're afraid. Like, well, that's because we're afraid if you misspeak, you're going to get shot. Sorry. That was low-hanging Riesling that I went for there. Sorry about that.
Was it ever? I think the thing is, you talk sort of.
My last name is Schott. The only people I can make fun of are the Germans and the Irish. Let me go.
There you go.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, I think if you talk about it in terms of kind of the meta-marketing, even if you mispronounce French words, the fact that you are attempting to do so makes you appear to be very urbane and seductive in the eyes of your date.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are at the table hoping to score, and you have decided to place an order for Zeltinger Himmelreich Riesling Cabinet Halbtrocken, you feel like Colonel Klink, and you're probably going home by yourself.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I look more like Sergeant Schultz, though.
Well, you know, I think there are some other things that mitigated against it. I mean, I don't get that same discrimination, like the feeling of that it's not important. I get there's a fear of pronouncing that language because I think There's just less familiarity with trying to flub your way through it. But I found, you know, being one of the early adopters and selling tableside in a restaurant, which is the best way to sell wine for me, for Mark, and because Mark and I are tableside in the restaurant, we get to talk to you about it. Then I get to open it and pour it, and I taste it to make sure it's not corked. And, you know, we sort of have it together, you know.
Yeah.
And it was great to be able to serve these wines that way rather than to send someone home with a case or a bottle, because people are fundamentally unsure, I think, of a new thing, especially if it doesn't. And so these Austrian wines didn't have a lot of sweetness to them.
Right. I think the German wines have that slight advantage of a lot of them had that sweetness, so you could use sugar to introduce somebody to something that they might not otherwise introduce themselves to.
And if you've gone home and you're at your kitchen table with you and your wife alone, and you're like, geez, I don't know if this is good or worth it, and you open that bottle and you pour it, and it's sort of pleasantly sweet, tastes a little bit like an apple, and you know, it may have all sorts of other things going on, but you say, oh, well, I know it's good. Whereas if people go home with more challenging wines and they open them by themselves and they think, well, you know, if this were a bad bottle, how would I know? Is this what this is supposed to taste like? And because there's not the same frame of reference and it's not related, it's really quite distant, which is one of the things that's wonderful. It's quite distant from Chardonnay, Cabernet, Pinot Noir, or Syrah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, it was a great thing that we were able to do in the restaurants was to pour it side by side and then pour it with food and sort of smile and reassure people when we would taste the wine for cork that this is indeed how it was supposed to be.
Yeah, exactly. And, God, there's so many interesting kind of subtexts to what you just said. You're right about, you know, sweetness being a kind of a palliative and something, a pivot point for people who are trying something new. If it's perplexing to them, at least it's palatable.
Right.
But there's a really important message, I think, embedded in what you say, and I would frame it in the form of a question. Do people really like dry white wines? Because if you look at the most popular dry white wines, they are rendered most of all so as to be creamy and soft.
Right.
They may or may not technically contain residual sugar, but they are certainly accommodating and seductive to the drinker for the most part. There are, of course, exceptions. But, you know, again, look at the ostensibly dry wines that are in the commercial mainstream. They're, you could almost accuse them of pandering to the drinker with this kind of spurious, fleshy, seductive creaminess. They're very curvaceous and they're very caressing. But are they really what we mean by dry?
Well, I think, Terry, one of the things that you're alluding to here and is something that Frances and I talk about all the time is when you taste those wines, and I think a lot of people when they're tasting wine, they think about the wine in a context only about the wine.
Mm-hmm.
Where so some of those creamy textures and some of those lush textures and some of the things that you're talking about, that richness, that mouthfeel, some of those things that you're talking about that are in most of the mainstream white wines that are out there, and frankly some of the reds too. I think you're talking about the wine only if I were going to sip 2 ounces of this wine, would this be pleasurable, rather than I'm about to have a meal and I'm going to have something with this, what do I want to have to kind of put those things together with?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you know, we see this all throughout the wine community. It's kind of a rather pitiable failure to consider wine in the context in which it is used, because we've turned it into this kind of specimen to which an absolute value is awarded. And I'm not going to go off onto a jag about point scores here, but I think a really salient issue with them is that they cannot refer to wine as it is used, but only to how it is judged. And judging is such an infinitesimally small subcategory of the way wine is actually used by human beings in their lives, on a wide range of ambiences and occasions with a wide range of foods.
Well, and to go back to the analogy that I always do when we talk about making a quantitative assessment of, and it's a very American game when you have three wines in front of you to say, okay, If you ask an American, say, okay, we have five wines in front of us. What are we going to do? And the American will say, you know, well, we're going to find out which one's the first best and which one's the second best and which one's
that's
the
right.
third best.
Yeah,
and if you ask a Frenchman...
Like, who's your favorite Marx brother?
Right. So if you ask people from other cultures, they'll say, well, let's try them and see what we should have them with and how we should drink them and if we like them and do you like one better than I do? You know, it's, mm-hmm. And I always make the analogy when we talk about point scores is... you know, if you were walking through the Prado Museum in Spain and you saw, you know, nine American tourists walking around the Prado and you heard one say to the other, you know, I gave the Velázquez a 94, but I gave the Degas an 87. You'd say, what are you, an idiot?
We had a great discussion.
Call the uniformed guard and say this Philistine needs to be.
Well, I can only imagine. I can only imagine a sheet of paper they would all have to like rank the paintings in the Prado in order from best to worst. You know,
we had a great discussion with Randall Graham about pointillism, which is something that he discussed in his book, and I know in your book you've spent some time talking about point scores and how you know they may be good for selling wine, but they're not really great for educating about wine.
Right. And they compel the question about, we have to acknowledge the point that some wines are better than others,
yes.
Obviously. And in strict consumerist terms, it's not a bad idea to have a referee out there who's tasting through the megilla thousands of wines to help steer people towards the ones that he thought were best. But then you have to continually ask the question, does the occasion call for the best wine?
Well, and I think you also, you say in your book about the point system, one of the great advances of Robert Parker, and one of the, you know, by his standards and by the standards of the people who value that system in the Wine Spectator and the Wine Advocate, is the 100-point scale, which is really a 50-point scale or wherever they start,
right.
You know. But you say in your book that the utility of a point system is in inverse proportion to its purported accuracy. So
exactly.
A system that makes a distinction between a 97 and a 98 point wine is really just much more of a fallacy than the old, you know, 10 point scale or 20 point
mm-hmm.
scale.
Or
that
5
sort of,
point scale.
Or that gives you an idea of like, okay, this is a really well made extraordinary wine. This is an exceptional wine. This is substandard. This is adequate. And this is a really poorly made wine. And then within
mm-hmm.
that context, because, you know, that doesn't give you enough information. It makes you say, okay, well, I know it's a well made wine, but what is it? Instead of it's a 97.265. You know, that's, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, why stop at 100 points? You may remember our mutual friend Bill Adams
yep.
positing a 1,000-point scale
mm-hmm. yeah.
with hieroglyphics.
See, but I think that, and I remember Bill Adams used to work for Terry and was originally...
And lived, ironically, on Livingston Avenue in New Brunswick,
yeah,
New
really
Jersey.
Crazy.
So.
That's right.
You know how Bill found us? You know how Bill found us? And Bill was talk about an astute wine sales rep when he represented your wines throughout the country. He was walking down Livingston Avenue with his children, and our recycling was out. And he noticed the quality of the wine bottles in our recycling and knocked on the door and said, hello, I represent Terry Thies.
So basically what he did was go through our garbage.
Pretty much. That's investigative wine sales, I'll tell you that much.
Wow, that's not in the Andrew Carnegie books.
And at the same time, he learned we had a really good credit score.
Yeah, exactly. But what I remember, though, is he wanted to do the 1,000-point scale. I wanted to do the 110-point scale.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a little misleading. You're like, you got a 99. Yeah, but, you know, who knows? It's on a 110-point scale, you know?
That's right.
It's 100.
You know, the other thing is, let's suppose that the first Kumamotos have arrived from the West Coast, and you've got just a big Jones for oysters. And if you apply the idea of this kind of bestism thing, and say you wanted to drink champagne with your oysters, and you were one of those fortunate people who could afford to drink Rotor or Cristal in a restaurant, you might order Cristal with your oysters, and you would probably have a significant mismatch of wine and food, not mm-hmm. to mention wine and occasion. But if you ordered a nice, dry, non-vintage Blanc de Blanc with your oysters and saved yourself a fortune in the process, if, in other words, you drank the 86-point wine instead of the 93-point wine, you'd have an entirely better experience that time.
Yep, yep. But you wouldn't have as much status, and you couldn't tell your friends that you drank the Rotor.
See, I thought you were going to go with some Zecht somewhere. I thought for sure.
So let's go
hey,
back.
Man, I'm not that egalitarian.
Let's go back to your question before, and I'm curious as to why you pose it and how you would answer it. do people really like dry white wine? And my answer would be, initially, I think they do not. But I think that people, when they have their first sip of coffee, do not like that. And when you're a kid and you steal your father's beer for the first time, and you think, why do they drink that? It's terrible. But I think that it is an acquired taste, and I think it's a taste worth acquiring.
But it's our show, so we get to ask the questions. Do people really like dry white wine, Terry?
Yeah. I have to agree with Francis. It is an acquired taste, and a lot of people stop short of acquiring it because they let themselves be seduced into thinking that these kind of creamy slut wines that they're drinking are dry wines.
Slut wines. That's really
slut
great.
Wines. And that they are dry wines, and they just kind of stop at that point. They say, well, I have attained the self-image that I want. I am a drinker of dry wines, and I don't need to explore this issue any further. And every once in a while, they will accidentally stumble onto something that strikes them as being sour or shrill, and they'll say, oh, no, I don't like those kinds of wines at all. I like dry wines.
Yeah, yeah. Dry is the most overused word in the lexicon of the consumer they use it to apply to everything.
But I must say, you use the term being seduced in a negative with a negative connotation. Is being seduced really such a bad thing?
I think it depends on who's doing the seducing. Actually.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really, do you respect yourself in the morning?
Is it Victoria's Secret or Fredericks of Hollywood? You know,
there you that's go. The, exactly. Yeah.
That's the idea.
This show is just going the wrong way.
We are
going the wrong way.
We are dorks.
Well, yes, it often happens when I'm involved in the conversation.
I know. You bring out the inner dork in Mark and I, Terry. I have to tell you, it's great.
Mark and me.
There you go.
Very fun to find it,
so, reading between the lines, why did you write this book? And now, you've been doing this for a long time. You're an extremely literate and intelligent person, and you know that I don't like to pay compliments to you, so that was a well-earned compliment.
Ooh, man.
Exactly. You're sitting down. Reading between the lines, why this book? Why, I think it's a really intelligent book, very much in your style of speaking. I can hear you in the prose. Why this book? Why now? And what are you saying that hasn't been said before?
Oh, wow. A three-point question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, initially, getting the Beard Award kind of made me feel a little bit pensive. You know, at that point, getting a James Beard Award is one of those things that you actually start thinking about your career and where you are in it and what you have accomplished and blah, blah, blah. So it's a sort of you start thinking of yourself in legacy terms, if that doesn't sound too pompous. And so I began thinking, you know, I've been gestating this book for 20 years, and people who've read my sales catalogs have known forever that they're not just sales catalogs. So then I really kind of felt, what am I waiting for? There's really no time like the present to write this book. I kept thinking that I would take a sabbatical and I was going to do all these ambitious things with a book that I would eventually write. And then I just began feeling, I have the material. Why don't we at least just sort of sit down, get it out, and see what it amounts to? So I took a few months, working mostly evenings and weekends, enjoying the hummingbirds at the feeder on my balcony as I was writing. And I tried to sort of limn the greater values in the work that I did. And I looked at the wine literature that already existed, and I found that there were essentially three kinds of books. There were very scholarly guides, some better written than others, but many of them extremely helpful. Then there were, and these were guides to regions and sort of fundamental wine types. Then there were buyer's guides, and I couldn't understand in many cases why those even came out at all in book form, because they were obsolete almost by the time they went to print.
Right.
And the magazines and journals, and particularly now the internet blogs, were doing a much better job of keeping current on what wines people ought to buy. And then there were also wine simplification books, Wine Made Easy, Wine for Dummies, Wine for Complete Idiots, you know, all this other stuff that was kind of like...
Wine for a particularly moronic person.
Exactly. You know, it's sort of like you can either teach a child to walk by encouraging the child to walk, or you can give the child crutches and just say, there, Junior, you don't need to walk. You know, you'll be able to get around using these crutches. So I kind of looked at the wine simplification industry as offering the fledgling wine drinker crutches, and it didn't make sense to me. And what I wasn't really seeing out there at the time I sat down to write were any books that were telling people why they should give a rat's ass about wine in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, after all, about this beverage that has unleashed this flood of words throughout history, not to mention flood of emotions and flood of sensations and all this stuff? So wine has been something that's very meaningful in my own life. And so I just thought, you know, look, one might as well risk foolishness and go as far as one can go in describing wine's place in a life that's emotional, that's spiritual, that's soulful, that's sensual, that's juicy, that's fun, that's erotic in the Greek sense of eros as being the force of life, not in strictly carnal terms, although wine is certainly, apropos of seduction, been a very helpful agent from time to time in that process. So once the book actually was sent to the publisher, it then occurred to me that there was beginning to be a kind of an alt-wine lit, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could almost say that Matt Kramer was the granddaddy of that. It certainly picked up steam, I think, with Osborne's The Accidental Connoisseur.
Mm-hmm.
Alice Firing's book is an important contribution to the genre, and I'm sure her next one will be as well. And then you had John Nossiter's book, Liquid Memory. John establishes his reasons for why wine matters, and that's the subtitle of his book, are couched in kind of political, cultural, anthropological, and ethical terms, because that's the kind of person he is. And I think his book is lovely, notwithstanding the criticisms that have been made against it. I think his book is lovely because it is the honest gesture of his particular soul. For me, wine was always a much more intimate and spiritual experience. I don't deny that it has cultural and anthropological resonances, but I care less about that than I care about the particular singular moment of ignition between one glass and one human soul.
And the spiritual nature of the book, I think, is fascinating. And what's more fascinating to me is the tremendous success this book has been written about everywhere. Considering that it's not crutches at all. But listen, we're gonna have to take a quick break, Terry. And on the other side, I want to talk about the success of your book,
and
some of the specifics that you from inside it. So we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Terry Theis about his new book, Reading Between the Wines. Reading Between the Wines. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work. Vinfinity system for restaurants and bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them The Restaurant Guys sent you. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Terry Theis is our guest. His book is Reading Between the Wines. You can find it at RestaurantGuysRadio.com and in bookstores everywhere. Okay, so, Terry, this is a philosophical book on wine. It's not a how-to guide. There are no scores in here. You don't even have a buying guide, goddammit. When I read the book, I got an early copy of the book, and it took us a while, I'm sorry to say, to get you on the show. We just had trouble getting the schedules in for recording days. But since then, I've been surprised to see this reviewed everywhere and written about everywhere and suggested as a present to give everywhere. You must be surprised at the success of the book. Would you consider it a runaway success?
Well, it's hard to call it a runaway success, except, of course, in the very small scale that these things are judged. I mean, we are in our second printing, and a third printing has been ordered, and that sounds terribly impressive to say, but the size of these printings is very small. And I'm happy, you know, Friends, let me put it this way. Being published by a university press, I had to undergo peer review for the manuscript. And the first person to whom it was sent didn't like it.
Oh, that must have hurt.
It was unnerving, let us say. And I found this person's comments, kind of looked at this person's comments, and I thought, well, the book, and I never knew who it was, but I really just sort of felt this was not an intelligent reader of goodwill. This book went over his head or hers. And this reviewer seems to have decided fairly early on, I don't like this man. I don't like his authorial voice. I don't think his manuscript hangs together. I think it's incoherent, blah, blah, blah. So I kind of looked at that, and I thought, it is the risk I calculated when I wrote the book the way I did, when I wore my heart on my sleeve, when I let myself make a claim for the ethereal as a valid part of everyday experience. So we then had several other peers who reviewed the book, and they came back liking it very much. So my sense when it was published was that there were going to be people who really loved it. There were people to whom it would speak, because our sort of temperament is a relatively solitary one, a relatively lonely one. We were the kinds of people, to use Woody Allen's famous line, who were not popular as elementary school students. What did he say? Something, I was beaten up by Quakers, I think he said.
right.
Which is, you know, sort of funny. We were the kind of the shy, introverted, geeky types. So you write a book like that out of that place, and I tried to write this out of the most legitimate and authentic place in my soul I could find. And the people to whom it appeals, it will appeal greatly. It is a comfort to them. Someone else is out there. Someone is making verbal the feelings that they have felt they had to feel in solitude, or the thoughts that they didn't dare express for fear of ridicule. So someone else kind of died on that particular cross for them. You know, it's like, okay, if somebody's going to be seen ridiculous, it might as well be me. So there was that. What has not materialized very much yet was something that I expected to materialize, and that was a certain irritation that some people might have felt about the book. Again, you know, because it does challenge a number of pretty prevailing shibboleths, and it tries to do so in a reasonable voice, but it also is occasionally quite passionate and pointed. So you asked if I was surprised by the almost universally sunny reception that the book has received, and I would say certainly surprised, pleasantly so, and it seems as if I might have a little tiger by the tail with this book.
Yeah, well, I gave it a 97. I thought
exactly.
It was...
And you would have given it 100, but you gave the author picture a 68.
So what I'm hearing from you in all of this, to take it to the next step or the next conclusion, is this book may not appeal to everybody, but maybe this book doesn't appeal to everybody because these types of wines aren't going to appeal to everybody.
That could be.
I mean, is that what you're thinking here? Is that, you know, will these wines ever be kind of broadly accepted?
Well, you know, I didn't really write the book specifically about German or Austrian wines or champagnes. I mean, to the extent that I used examples from my life to illustrate certain points, those were the examples I used because those are the things that have happened to me. But what I'm positing here is a definition of authentic wines that occur more frequently in the old world than they do in the new, and they occur just as often in France and Italy, certainly, as they do in Germany or Austria or Champagne. So I can't really say that if the book has limited appeal, it wouldn't be because the wines that I'm talking about have limited appeal. Some of the wines that embody the virtues, which I think are crucially important in great wine, have quite a lot of appeal. So, sorry, I have to reject the premise of the question. Please don't hate me.
All right, we accept your rejection of the premise, but we do hate you anyway. No,
okay.
We've loved each other for a long, long time. All right, so but here's let's talk about then. You make a real distinction in your book between wines that you view as authentic and real and having soul and being important,
mm-hmm.
and those wines being able to speak to people on a maybe on a spiritual level. Yeah. And there are wines that are just commercially, technologically, commercially, maybe correct or maybe incorrect, but designed to be sold to a consumer. And
yes.
Talk to me about the difference between wines that can speak to you as a human being, if you're open to that, and wines that are
designed for the consumer.
And is there crossover? I mean, are there crossover wines as well? What's the difference between those two wines?
I don't think there are crossovers. It's a rather difficult thing to say. I grew up my father was a classic sort of Adlai Stevenson liberal who felt that most problems, social or political or for that matter moral or ethical problems, could be discussed reasonably and civilly, and common ground was available to be found. So, you know, I come to that question as somebody who fundamentally wishes to find common ground, but I must say here I don't think you can. Either you have had a wine contrived to appeal to the market segment that has been identified for it, or you have just tried to serve whatever your vineyard seems to be wanting to say as best you possibly could, and figuring that the right sort of people would find their way to the results. And every time as a wine merchant that I've ever attempted not to craft a wine, because I don't make wines, but every time I've tried to kind of override my lack of passion for a wine by telling myself, boy, there's a whole lot of people who are going to like this. This wine will really be successful. This wine will really be personal. Or it will appeal to the XYZ drinker, blah, blah, blah. I've always fallen on my face. I'm not good at it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at it because I can't do things well that don't arise from conviction within me. And if I don't feel that conviction, then it simply shows. My work becomes mediocre. So, you know, I posit a sort of definition of authenticity, which is different here from a definition of wine quality. But I want wines to be connected to the soils from which they grew, to the people who midwifed them into being, and to a larger culture that allows these kinds of kind of small batch wine artisans making their terroir-driven wines to flourish. And some of those wine growers may embody all of those things, but not be especially good grape growers, or not have especially excellent cellar work, or maybe they're just a bit lazy. So the thing that can be difficult for people to perceive here is that this is a prerequisite not for quality. It's a prerequisite for authenticity. Quality follows from this, but not invariably. But I think that we all know the kinds of people who believe that their land is as existentially legitimate as they themselves are, who don't feel that they have dominion over nature, who approach the vineyard as a living organism that existed before they came along to take care of it and will continue to exist after they're gone and someone else has, one hopes, come along to take care of it, that these people are content, in Andrew Jeffords' words, to be Stradivari in the vineyard but not to be Stalin in the cellar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they recognize that the most crucial and vital part of their work is to do in the vineyard what a good gardener does in his garden, to show it the love, so that what grows will grow and flourish beautifully and expressively. And once you do that, then why in the world would you want to interfere in the winery? Why would you want to show off all the cool tricks that you've learned? The best thing you can do in that case is you've grown the most expressive possible fruit. Just try to let it get into the glass without interference. You've heard me say this before, Francis. I think it's the smartest thing that's ever been said about wine. Hans-Gunter Schwarz said it, the old cellar master at Müller Quatuor, a seminal figure in modern German winemaking. He said, the best thing a cellar master can know is the right time to do nothing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a less is more approach in the cellar, because you realize that what you've brought in from the vineyard, if you did it right, is already perfect.
You know,
and everything you do takes a certain vitality out of that there is no way to put back.
Right.
So,
well, we see that on a macro level when you start fining and filtering wines, when you start doing too much, you know, why wouldn't that be the same on a micro level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you see it, of course, also in cuisine.
Yep.
You know, you'll go to a place, you'll have something as simple as, let's say, it's a plate of piselli in a really good trattoria. And you taste them and you think, God, it's like I never ate a pea before.
Yeah, that's true. You know, it's funny. We're finding this more and more, and you're finding this more and more in food with this whole eat local movement. I mean, one of the things that we find as we found in our kitchen for years, and now we're finding behind the bar, and we have one of the top 100 cocktail bars in America and the one in New Jersey, and we have moved to rediscovering old recipes, some of which are very simple. But the simplest recipes that call for fruit, because, of course, we're trying to keep our bars as seasonal as our kitchens.
Right.
And we find that some of these old recipes that sort of fell into disuse for 50 years and we're trying to resurrect on the other side, when it calls for – there's a wonderfully simple book called cocktail called a strawberry cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
It appeared in Eric Felton's book recently, and it's strawberries, orange juice, and bourbon. And made with this California strawberry from the supermarket, it is the most vile, disgusting thing you can imagine.
It's an actual disgusting drink.
But for the 4 weeks that we have fresh local strawberries of, you know, old varieties that are connected to New Jersey in here, it is the most wonderful cocktail. But it has to be made with those fruits. So, like Mark said, when you see that on such a macro level, when you're talking about something that's as intimate and complex as wine, obviously it should speak to your soul in a similar way.
Yeah, I agree completely, and particularly in the case of food, eating locally also maintains a connection to where you are in time and space.
Well,
you know, where you are in the planet, and what time of year it is, and what is growing, and you know, the less distance, assuming of course that the food is well cultivated in the first place, and the less distance it has to travel, the more of its innate vitality will be preserved. Not to mention the fact that you tend to then not commodify it. If a strawberry is a commodity that you simply demand because you're so adorable that you should be able to get strawberries whenever you want, and you want to eat Peruvian strawberries or something in the middle of January, then you are taking a different approach to food than you are if you've waited 10 months or 10 and a half months for the strawberries to arrive, and then they arrive and you celebrate them.
Yeah, it's wild.
You know, I really missed you guys.
Well, you know.
Welcome back. It's spring.
Food should be celebration, and wine should be a celebration, because we only have a certain number of days on this planet. And Terry Thies's new book, Reading Between the Wines, will help you figure out how to maybe put wine in a better place in your life to enhance the days that you have here. Terry, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
And thanks for writing the book. Terry's book, Reading Between the Wines, can be found at restaurantguysradio.com and in bookstores everywhere. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. You know, I get a little antsy when I'm talking to a guy that is smarter than I am. He's really eloquent, that Terry Thies, I have to tell you. But I learned when I went to Austria with him.
A lot of time when you're doing the show, then you get a little antsy.
That's not really true. No,
basically, every time you're in the room with me.
I knew what you meant. See, I'm not that slow. No, we always love German wines. We had a great experience with Terry when we first met through this guy, Bill Adams, who then just disappeared. Weird. But he introduced us to Terry's portfolio of German wines and Austrian wines. And we were able to
back in the early 90s. This is a long time ago.
93.
Yeah.
And in 93, we could still buy older wines.
Yep.
93, 94. Well,
there's still some out there.
But we were able to buy vertical selections. And we went from having a small, like, three German wines to having 25 German wines and 20 Austrian wines and multiple vintages on our list. And people thought, what the heck is this? And we turned a lot of people on.
Yeah, a lot of people really, really got their introduction during that time period. Us, too. I mean, we did the same thing.
It was amazing.
We got to taste a lot of cool wines.
We sold enough that Terry invited me to come to Austria. You know? And then it was, you know, and I've made many friends on my Austrian trip and learned an unbelievable amount. I've been back to Austria motorcycling with a number of times, but always motorcycling through vineyards, which is actually technically illegal late at night, but with the right people, you can do it. And I would come home, and my father always loved German wines. My last name is German, but I'm three quarters Irish and a quarter German. I don't know much about our German heritage. We just didn't stay in touch with our German family. But my father always loved German wines. And he had, sometime when I was in grammar school, come across Zeller Schwarzkatz. Schwarz means black. Kat is cat, right? And he would, Zeller Schwarzkatz, $6 then, $5, $6 a bottle back then. A little bit sweet. Honestly, not terrible. Yeah. Nothing really.
And really popular right around the same time as Blue Nun that Terry mentioned in his
70s.
Book. Really, really one
it
of those.
It was actually a half step up, a little teeny step up from the Blue Nun. And my dad loved this wine on every Thanksgiving and every Christmas. And we would always have the Zeller Schwarzkatz. And it had a little black cat that was like on a ribbon to the neck of the bottle. And I used to collect the little black cats. Anyway, so now I'm all grown up and I know all about wine. So I'm going to please my dad. And I would bring home Zeltinger, Sonnener, Auslese. I would bring home back vintages of just all sorts of really great and often somewhat expensive. I mean, certainly way more expensive than the Zeller Schwarzkatz German wines. And my father, rest his soul, loved him dearly, would always say, he'd get through the meal, and he'd go he always had a good thing, never had a negative thing to say about anybody. And we'd finish the turkey dinner, we'd finish our Christmas dinner, and Dad would say, "You know, son, that wine you brought was very, very good. It's almost as good as the Zeller Schwarzkatz." It would kill me. It would kill me. And you know what wisdom is? Sometime around my 32nd year, I would buy Zeller Schwarzkatz.
Attaboy. That's the stuff.
Of course, I brought the other stuff for me, and I kept it under my chair. And you know what? There's certain times where, you know, wine has a different relationship to your soul, and it's all about family and tradition. And so Zeller Schwarzkatz.
The moral of the story is, bring your dad what he wants.
Yeah, and also, and if Zeller Schwarzkatz, maybe this Thanksgiving, I will bring a bottle of Zeller Schwarzkatz to Thanksgiving dinner. It will remain unopened on the sideboard, but it'll be but it'll be there just as a reminder.
You should all drink a toast.
I hope that you enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.